Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the issue of cruelty and abuse of animals. April is Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, so we thought that it would be a good opportunity to explore some of these issues. And we have as our guest someone who's been working in this area for quite a long time, more than 25 years. His name is Randall Lockwood. He is currently the Senior Vice President for Anti-Cruelty Initiatives and Training at the ASPCA. That's the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. His academic training is in psychology, has a doctorate in comparative and physiological psychology from Washington University. Before taking on his present post, he served as Vice President for Research and Educational Outreach for the Humane Society of the United States. And over the past 25 years or so, he has worked closely with humane societies, with animal care and control agencies, with dog trainers and law enforcement. He served as an expert on wolf and dog behavior, on dog aggression, on dog bite prevention, on illegal dog fighting, and also the interactions between people and animals. He's written articles that have appeared in many different publications, both scholarly and popular. He is the co-author of the book Forensic Investigation of Animal Cruelty, A Guide for Veterinary and Law Enforcement Professionals, that book that was published in 2006. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana if you're listening over the air, and around the country if you're listening on the internet. And that number is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief in their comments, so we can keep moving along. But anyone can call in here if you have a question or comment to offer. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Lockwood, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Okay.
The thing I think is the place to start, and I think that it is interesting and noteworthy, as you've noted in some of the things that I've read about you, is that in the past, let us say the past decade or so, there has been a significant change in the way as a society we think about the issue of cruelty to animals in a couple of different ways. And maybe let me just ask you about what you've seen in terms of just public perception, public awareness to this being a problem, and a recognition by people that it in fact is a problem.
Right. I think the question I get asked most by the media is animal cruelty on the rise? And we really don't know, because there is no good uniform national tracking. Certainly public concern is on the rise, and our laws have become increasingly tough opposing animal cruelty. When I got started in the business about 25 years ago, we had maybe half a dozen states where the most egregious forms of animal cruelty might be prosecuted as a felony offense, as a serious crime. We are now up to about 44 states. Only a handful do not have that provision. We now have dog fighting is a felony in every state, and cockfighting is now illegal in every state. And these have all just come about in the last year or so. So I think one of the things that's produced this is finally a recognition of what many people have long believed, that there is this connection between animal cruelty and other forms of violence, family violence and societal violence in general, and a large and growing body of literature that supports that, the common sense idea, and greater recognition among frontline law enforcement people that the people that they are dealing with who have been involved in crimes against animals are not nice people, and they're people that we are justifiably concerned about. Also the recognition that often animal cruelty in the context of family violence can be a good indicator that there is other abuse going on in domestic violence and child abuse and elder abuse. So this growing recognition, I think, that's come really in the last 15 years or so of the interconnectedness of animal cruelty to lots of other forms of violence has been one of the things really pushing public and political interest in this. Another factor I think that's helped is the proliferation of shows like our own Animal Precinct that highlights the activities of the humane law enforcement agents of the ASPCA. People have realized there are, in fact, law enforcement agents out there whose job it is to respond to cruelty to animals, and something can be done. And those shows have been very popular, have spawned a lot of spin-offs, and again, that has given people a sense that, oh, there is something I can do. There are people who will respond to the things that do disturb me. Mm-hmm. So we really have seen a dramatic change, I think, just even in the last decade, mm-hmm. on taking animal cruelty seriously.
Yeah, and not just, I think it's interesting that we're not just talking about the idea that people believe that animals are worthy of protection and that abusing them is wrong, but that extends not just, it's not just a general thing, but that extends to the way people treat the animals that they live with, and that maybe at one time we would have said, well, that's not my business the way they treat their dog, just like we might have one time said it's not my business the way they treat their children, but that increasingly people seem to be willing to involve themselves in the lives of their neighbors and other people in their community to the extent that they say that, in fact, that you can make the argument that is in the community's interest and it's not just a private matter.
Yes, I think one of the things that regular police officers and prosecutors have recognized is that animal cruelty is one of those kind of broken window type crimes. You know, if you have dog fighting going on in the community or even just other forms of animal cruelty, and nothing is done, it sends the message that law enforcement doesn't really care what's happening, and taking those crimes seriously has now considered to be a good part of community-oriented policing. And we are incorporating more and more information on that. And in fact, Illinois has been one of the leaders for about a year and a half, 2 years now. We have had an online course available for police officers in Illinois on a basic introduction to animal cruelty investigation and response that can fulfill some of the police officers' continuing education requirements in the state of Illinois. And that's been sponsored through the Regional Institute of Community Policing, which has offices there in Urbana. So they've been very helpful in getting the word out to law enforcement agencies throughout the state, and we've just gone nationwide with a similar training program in about 40 states for police officers to give them basic grounding in animal cruelty investigation and response.
Mm-hmm. Let me just again introduce our guest, if anyone who's tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Randall Lockwood. He is the Senior Vice President for Anti-Cruelty Initiatives and Training at the ASPCA. That's the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And we're talking about the issue of animal cruelty and abuse. April is, in fact, Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, so we thought it would be a good opportunity to spend some time talking about the particular issue and about how things have changed, particularly how attitudes have changed over time toward this problem, and that now we have increasingly people who believe that it is a problem and it's something that law enforcement really needs to address. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps in case there are some people who are not exactly sure what it is we're talking about, in the sense what constitutes animal cruelty, particularly if we're talking about not just in a general sense, but we're talking about the way people treat their own animals, that is, animals that live under their roof or they're under their care. What are the really the most common forms of cruelty? What are we talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the problems we have as a national organization is the fact that every state defines not only animal cruelty differently, but also animal. And in general, animal cruelty is addressed at the level of state laws, usually under the criminal code, sometimes under the agriculture and market codes. And as I say, some state laws apply to any animal. Some apply only to companion animals. There are all various exclusions. So one of the challenges for us is I basically carry a copy of every state's animal cruelty law around on my laptop, and Illinois alone is about 75-80 pages long. It's one of the longer ones. In general, the most common form of animal cruelty that animal care and control or humane law enforcement agency sees is basic, simple neglect, just failure to provide adequate food, water, shelter, veterinary care. And that's usually something that's going to be not handled by police directly. Usually that's going to be an animal control issue, and the attempt is to resolve this through education, whether the people are not providing proper care because they don't know what to do or don't have the proper resources. There's not necessarily malice involved. And frankly, those account for maybe 90% of the cases that most agencies are going to respond to, and usually don't necessarily indicate that this is someone who is a threat to society. And as I said, we try to resolve those through education. But then we get into intentional abuse, intentional cruelty, cruel treatment. And again, in Illinois, definition is no person may beat, cruelly treat, torment, starve, overwork, or otherwise abuse, and it's any animal. And that's pretty consistent in many states. These are the intentional acts of cruel treatment, and that can be treated as a felony in Illinois and about 44 other states where you have intentional or aggravated cruelty if there's serious injury or death. Another unique form that we have of neglect, of serious neglect, is animal hoarding. And we could do a whole show just on that, the cat ladies or dog men, people who have far too many animals to care for adequately. And that's a very different dynamic and different underlying psychology. And again, Illinois is fairly unique in that they have a specific law that defines animal hoarding as a unique offense. We also then deal with, so we've got simple neglect, we've got aggravated neglect, or we have cases of the animal hoarding. Then we have sort of the organized abuse, particularly dogfighting and cockfighting. And again, those are a felony. Dogfighting is a felony in every state, cockfighting in I think about 20 states, and other forms, pitting animals against animals. We see variations on that in a variety of states. And then I guess the final form we sometimes are dealing with is animal sexual assault and bestiality, which again some states specifically address and quite a few really don't. So that's the range, and the kinds of things that we tend to see the most law enforcement action on are the intentional abuse cases, the burnings, shootings, stabbings, poisonings, and the animal hoarding cases, and then the organized abuse in dogfighting. Mm-hmm. That probably makes up the bulk of the serious cases that might actually find their way into court.
The case, one particular, just in terms of its psychology, I guess I would say is, if you'll permit me to say it's interesting, is animal hoarding, in the sense that one wonders how exactly this happens, what it is that the person thinks that they're doing. And here we have the case where people, they don't believe that they're abusing their animals, that somehow they apparently have the idea that they're providing homes for animals that otherwise wouldn't have them, or maybe they would just say that they love animals, but that what they have is they have far too many animals than they can care for, and often the animals end up living in very, very bad circumstances, very poorly cared for, maybe not fed properly, don't have regular medical care. And some of the when you see some of these cases, that they're truly heartbreaking when you see that the conditions the animals are living in. And yet at the same time, that person somehow seems not to understand what it is they're doing, and seems not to understand that they're not doing good things for these animals. Is this something that we just got more notice of, or it has gotten public attention, or maybe because it is something that law enforcement now addresses? Or do we actually see more of this?
We certainly are seeing more cases coming to our attention. I get a daily update on animal hoarding cases, and I probably get two or three new cases a day coming across my desk. We've been involved in several just in the last few weeks. Several of our staff were helping out with the Pennsylvania SPCA and responding to an alleged animal rescue group or cat rescue group that had over 600 cats, many dead and dying. And it was very much as you've described, where the person involved, you know, claims to be a rescuer. And increasingly, we see maybe 25% or more of the cases we see are what we would characterize as the rescue hoarders. They often have in fact incorporated as a nonprofit. They are raising money, and yet the conditions are not unlike the, you know, the crazy cat lady down the street, where you do have a lot of animals living in filth, dead and dying. And these are very difficult cases for both law enforcement and animal control to deal with. First, for the number of animals involved, we are talking about often hundreds of animals. That case involved, I think, over 600 cats. We had a case of several hundred dogs recently in Ohio. I think the largest case I was involved in had over 1,100 dogs in New York State. And often the individuals involved do lack insight into the problems they're causing, and yet they are otherwise well-adjusted people who are fitting into mainstream society. Animal hoarders have included, you know, doctors, lawyers, nurses, teachers, even some veterinarians. Typically, our animal hoarders are of above-average intelligence, above-average education, but they are totally lacking in insight to the problems they're causing. And one hoarder case can tie up the resources of a local animal care and control agency for months, if not years. So these are very difficult. And in terms of the number of animals, you know, we get very concerned about the, you know, young male that might brutally kill a cat because of his potential for violence against others, but he has killed one or two animals quickly. Our typical animal hoarder case involves 50 or more animals, at least half of which die. So in terms of the actual amount of suffering and death that's caused, the animal hoarders are a much bigger challenge to humane investigators. They're causing a lot of pain and suffering, and yet they often appear to be very sympathetic. I've had judges write me letters saying, you were too hard on this person. She just loved her animals too much. And unfortunately, I think allowing animals to cannibalize each other is not my definition of love.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, again, makes it perhaps difficult to understand that on the one hand, I think that there are perhaps people who are prepared to make the argument that animal hoarding may indeed be a kind of mental illness,
right,
or that has mental health sort of components. And that on the other hand, though, that the people who are doing this would be able to say and honestly believe it, would be able to say to you or an investigator or anybody would be able to say, well, I don't think I'm doing anything wrong here, and actually in their own minds not think honestly that they weren't doing anything.
That is the frustrating thing about dealing with animal hoarders. If you stand in the house, which often is almost unbreathable with ammonia fumes and piled with feces, and you ask an intelligent, well-educated, and sometimes financially fairly well-off person, what would you like to change in your lifestyle? And they'll look around and say, well, nothing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just a little messy.
Yeah.
If even that, there is this denial. And there may be some underlying neurological problems. There have been some studies done on hoarders, not animal hoarders, but of other kinds of hoarders, which indicate certain abnormalities of brain metabolism. And the reality is there probably are several possible underlying psychological issues here, but mental disorder is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. We're not usually trying to get people, you know, have animal hoarders incarcerated. That usually the objective in responding to an animal hoarder case is first getting the animals out of a dangerous, often life-threatening situation, but also dealing with the fact that without intervention and monitoring, virtually all orders start up again. The recidivism rate is nearly 100%. And so usually what we go for in these cases is surrendering the animals, agreeing to regular inspection, compensating, if possible, the local animal controller, whoever has cared for the animals with the enormous expenses that have been involved, and then just keeping track of the situation and what we call relapse prevention. It is almost like dealing with an addiction, which does require kind of constant monitoring to ensure that it doesn't start up again. And sometimes we're criticized for going after what are seemingly, you know, sweet little old ladies. And about two-thirds of the hoarders are women, and most are older, although we've had couples and single men and all variations. But sometimes you need the criminal prosecution in order to get a long period of probation that gives you the authority to remove animals from a life-threatening situation and to monitor the situation for as long as possible.
And I guess just to make sure that people who are listening know what we're talking about, we're not here talking about people who maybe live with multiple companion animals and people who have two dogs and three cats and a hamster and a
right.
and a parrot. I mean, you know, that's really not for some people that might be more animals in the house that they would like to have, but that is not what it is we're talking
about. And actually, Illinois law very specifically defines what's meant by hoarder situation, and it is, you're right, it's not just the absolute number of animals. And I'm asked that a lot because many of the people I deal with are obviously in animal welfare, animal protection, and they'll say, well, how many animals makes me a hoarder? I joke with some of my own staff who have up to 15 or 16 animals, and I say, it's not a question of the numbers, it's a question of the quality of life. And the thing that characterizes a true hoarding situation is that you have a large number of animals that are in poor condition, and you are unaware of or unresponsive to the condition under which the animals are living and the environment that that creates for them and for other people. Again, about a fourth of our animal hoarders have dependent humans living with them, either children or very often older parents or handicapped adults. So very often people are being forced to live into the same abysmal conditions that the animals are. And the hoarders themselves often also, at some level, seem to be oblivious to the fact that there is feces everywhere, and yet they often will put on clean clothes to go to work and then come home and change back into their grubbies and live in filth.
Yeah.
And part of the issue in the past has been that social services didn't want to take on the role of being the neat police. You know, they said, well, this is a lifestyle choice. And there's a difference between living in a house that's a bit cluttered and living in a house that has accumulated animal and human urine and feces. You know, that's then a psychopathology. And I do a lot of training for adult protective service workers and child protective service workers to try to break out of that mindset that, they often judge a situation as being dangerous if the lifestyle is a threat to themselves or others, but animals don't usually rate as a relevant other. But certainly when you have children or older adults or handicapped people forced to live in the same conditions, then social service really must take notice.
We are at our midpoint here, and let me again, for the benefit of anybody who's just tuned in, introduce our guest, Dr. Randall Lockwood. He served as Vice President for Research and Educational Outreach for the Humane Society of the United States until 2005, when he went to work for the ASPCA, that's the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. He serves as the Senior Vice President for Anti-Cruelty Initiatives and Training. His academic background is in psychology, has a doctorate in comparative and physiological psych from Washington University. He has been working in this area for a long time. He's worked with humane societies, with animal care and control agencies, with dog trainers, with law enforcement. He served as an expert in a variety of subject areas, including wolf and dog behavior, dog aggression, dog bite prevention, illegal dog fighting, and generally the interactions between people and animals. He's written articles for both scholarly and popular publications, has been involved in a number of books, and a couple just to mention. One is Cruelty to Animals and Interpersonal Violence, published by the Purdue University Press back in the late 90s. And also he's the co-author of the book Forensic Investigation of Animal Cruelty, A Guide for Veterinary and Law Enforcement Professionals. April is Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, so we thought, well, this would be a good opportunity to talk about some of these issues. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What we're talking about here is, for example, with animal hoarding or organized abuse, which I want to talk a little bit about. Just going back for a second, though, to your comment that the most common form of animal abuse is, in fact, simple neglect. You said that maybe that's 90% of the cases. And here we're talking about people and the way that they're treating animals that they're living with, that they no doubt would consider their companion animals. They might not use that kind of language, but that. And here it is the case where people are just not, somehow they just don't understand what is appropriate care, and that the conditions that the animals are living under may be less than ideal. Maybe they're not getting appropriate diet. Maybe they're not getting appropriate medical care. And it seems that in this case, we're really not talking about bad people. We may, though, be talking about people who simply don't really understand what the animal's needs are, or maybe they don't have the means to provide for those needs. I'm not sure how many cases we're actually talking about something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, often it's a question of whether they are unwilling or unable to provide care, or just don't know what that care is. We hear a lot of complaints about animals that are pretty much just abandoned. You know, the dog chained in the backyard with inadequate food, water, or shelter. And many states can address that. That is a violation. But in some states, you know, if the dog has a turned-over 55-gallon drum and he's got food of some kind and the water's not too green, well, there's not too much that law enforcement might do. But the question, you know, everybody asks when they see a dog in that situation is, well, then why do they have a dog? If you're not enjoying it as and taking pleasure in the pleasure it takes in life, if you're not interacting with it. And a growing number of communities are actually passing laws against long-term chaining of animals as a cause both of suffering for the animal, but also a possible contributor to aggression in the animals. And again, raising that issue of why have you chosen to take this animal? It's not protecting your house if it's chained up. It's not benefiting you and your children learning to care for something and play with it and have fun with it. It's just there. And those are very common kind of situations. And as I say, probably maybe close to 90% of the cases our agents respond to is the starving pit bull in the backyard kind of situation, which are usually resolved by forcing them to get the medical attention they need or feed the animal properly and check up on that. And they're, as you say, they're not necessarily bad people, the way those involved in intentional abuse might be considered. But it still is a challenge for enforcement.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. In Urbana, line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two quick questions, if you have a moment. One issue that's been in our local news, I'd say within the last year in particular, has been abandoned or abused horses. These, in many cases, have been situations where a neighbor may report seeing a horse down or a horse abandoned in a field. Oftentimes there are already dead horses on the property, and this seems to be a particular issue, especially as I'm reading about shortages of feedstocks and so forth. Do horses present a particular problem in your situation, or is there something you'd like to comment on that about that? And I'll ask my second question, and then I'll let you answer offline.
Mm-hmm.
The second question would be with the a very few cases that have been of pit bull type dogs that have been responsible for injuring humans, that has been fastened on, it seems, by the press and really blown up into a situation where many communities have passed laws against owning a pit bull or a pit bull type dog. Could you respond to this issue And my concern is that it's the misuse of the dog or the poor training that has made the animal in that case create a problem, and that many wonderful animals are being put in a category that they should not be in because of this. Could you comment on those two things, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Sure, I can address both of those. We are seeing lots of cases of equine abuse and neglect, and increasingly cases of horses left with inadequate or little or no feed. And as the caller indicated, those do produce real challenges because many humane societies do not have adequate facilities to care for or rehabilitate horses. But we are seeing more of that. As one of my friends who's a horse person has said, you know, hay has gotten to be pricier than gold these days. And that's been one issue. Another issue that's been put out there is some have argued that the shutting down of horse slaughter plants in Illinois and Texas and elsewhere has led to increased abandonment. And that there doesn't seem to be good evidence of that connection, that people who can no longer just sell their unwanted horses for slaughter are just abandoning them. We do have data from California where horse slaughter was banned several years ago, and there was no documented increase in horse abandonment. I think the problems we're seeing with horse neglect is more related to the general downturn of the economy, problems of climate, the incredibly high prices of good quality hay and feed. But the reality is, you know, we feel people should be as responsible, if not more so, for the horses in their care than the dogs and cats. These are animals that are expensive to care for. I had a horse for a while, and the upkeep was more than the car payments. And it is something that can be quite challenging. And I think we need to work with local humane societies and animal control agencies to better prepare them and equip them for caring for some of these cases. But that isn't a growing problem. The other question on the pit bull issue, ASPCA has long been opposed to breed-specific legislation. We do feel that people and their animals should be judged on their deeds and actions rather than on breeds. And we have supported strong, generic, dangerous dog regulations that hold people responsible for their actions of their animals, regardless of the breed. And it, as the caller indicated, you know, unfortunately, currently, pit bulls for quite a few years have been the dog of choice among people who might be inclined to be irresponsible. And I personally feel that one of the sources of the problems we've seen with pit bulls is in fact bans on pit bulls, because when you outlaw pit bulls, only outlaws own pit bulls, and that appeals then to the wrong element. Probably about half of my staff have pit bulls, and many of the animals that we place in our shelter in New York City are you know, very well behaved and friendly pit bulls that get along just fine. So we do support legislation that goes against breed-specific breed bans and breed-specific legislation, and we've been very involved in some of those efforts.
Mm-hmm. I guess that again points out something that I don't know if this is, I'm generalizing too much, but I think that it is generally true that dogs are social animals, that, however, dogs, any kind of a dog, can become dangerous to humans if it's been abused.
Yeah, and this is, I have been looking at and investigating fatal dog attacks for, again, over 25 years, and in that time I have seen just about every breed of dog involved in fatal attacks. We still only have about 15 to 20 fatal attacks a year, which is an enormous testimonial to the 50, 60 million dogs we have, and only a small number of these large predators are responsible for these incidents. And I used to say I've seen just about every breed involved except a beagle or a basset hound, and I just had a case in Hawaii earlier this year involving a basset hound. So beagles are still off the hook. But that does speak to the reality that any dog might bite, any dog might be involved in a serious attack. And we really should be looking for solutions that address irresponsible ownership and problems related to that.
Yeah. Again, just let me introduce our guests for this part of Focus 580, Dr. Randall Lockwood. He is the Senior Vice President for Anti-Cruelty Initiatives and Training with the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Also before that, worked for a number of years for the Humane Society. He was Vice President for Research and Educational Outreach, and he's been someone who has been dealing with, generally speaking, between human people interactions for a long time. And we're talking about the problem of animal cruelty and animal abuse, something that the month of April has been set aside to talk about. This is Animal Cruelty Prevention Month. And we thought, well, it'd be a good time. Obviously, it'd be a good thing to talk about any time, but particularly now. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned at the beginning of the program that the most common forms of animal cruelty are simple neglect, and then you get into cases of intentional cruelty, animal hoarding. I wanted to make sure we talk a little bit about organized abuse, because this is something that has been in the news fairly recently, and perhaps the thing that got people thinking about it was the case involving Michael Vick, a former professional football player who was involved in dogfighting. And now, as a result of increased awareness, I think you explained that in every state, this is illegal. It's a felony, but it wasn't always the case. And I think that at the time that this story got a lot of national attention, I think that there were a lot of people who would have said they would have been surprised that such a thing existed, or maybe they would say they would be surprised at how apparently widespread this activity really is.
That's right. I think Michael Vick case really was an eye-opener to the general public, the media, and legislators. We have bills pending in more than 20 states that would further toughen dogfight laws, things like making being a spectator at a dogfight a more serious crime, things like that. Also making it easier to hold participants in dogfighting accountable for, again, caring for the animals that are seized. The ASPCA was intimately involved in the Michael Vick investigation. Our staff was on the scene with agents of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and have been involved in gathering much of the evidence that was used, and proud that we recently did receive several of our staff received commendations from the U.S. Attorney's Office for our assistance in the case. But it was an eye-opener for a lot of people, but for many years we've been saying that dog fighting is widespread. It certainly goes on in every state in a variety of forms and has for throughout the history. The ASPCA actually was responsible for the first dogfight bust in the country back in 1868 when our agents raided Kit Burns's Sportsman's Palace, which was a major dogfight operation in New York City, and kind of great old woodcut of our agents busting the operation and driving the owner of the organization off to jail. So we've been fighting dogfighting for 140 years at the ASPCA, but the Vick case certainly brought it to the forefront of the news.
Yeah, it's really surprising that the extent to which this exists, or at least it surprises to me. We're talking about tens of thousands of people who are involved in this, and there's also a lot of money involved in it.
Absolutely. If you look just even at the records of the indictments in the Vick case, some of the fights in which he and his colleagues were involved had purses in excess of $10,000 up to $20,000, and there is a lot of money involved. That certainly is part of the incentive, and we have certainly heard of fights where there's been in excess of $100,000, you know, that's been seized at the scene. I've participated in a few raids where we have seized cash from someone who claimed to have no source of income, and yet he had about $20,000 in cash in his safe. So So there is money there, and that's part of the incentive for this. And again, that's gotten the interest of federal officials as well as state officials, because also invariably dogfighting seems to attract illegal drugs, illegal weapons, and a host of other crimes that go along with it.
Mm. It seems that one group of individuals that should be well positioned to at least see evidence and report evidence would be veterinarians if they're treating animals that have been hurt. That is, assuming that people who are involved in dogfighting to actually take injured animals to the vet. And apparently there is some states, but not very many states, that do require, and I guess Illinois is one of them, do require vets to report injuries if they think that that's the cause of the injuries, that is, an animal has been hurt in fighting. But apparently I'm a little bit surprised that it's not something that's a requirement in more states.
Right. It's only at this point, I think, about 10 to 12 states that actually require general reporting of suspected animal cruelty, and several states, including Illinois, Arizona, California, a few others, specifically mandate veterinarians to report suspected dogfighting. Although what we often find in the larger dogfight operations is they are not taking their animals to the vet. They're doing their own veterinary treatment, and I've seen makeshift clinics at some dogfight facilities that would rival the facilities of a lot of animal shelters or small veterinary hospitals. They've got surgical suites, they've got suturing material and antibiotics and drugs and things like that, and that's also often a tip-off to veterinarians if someone is seeking those kinds of things which no reasonable pet owner would ever really need.
And would we expect that an experienced veterinarian, if they saw an injured animal and looked at the kind of injuries, would be able to say to himself or herself, well, I think I know what's going on here. This animal has been fighting.
Well, that's one of the things that we do extensive training on. That most veterinarians don't receive any specific training on recognition of things that are fairly unique to animal cruelty and dogfighting in particular, and yet there are patterns of the kinds of injuries, the location of injuries, and the other kinds of evidence and drugs that might be seized that all add up to telling a story of involvement in dogfighting. We do training at virtually all the major veterinary conferences and many vet schools on recognition and reporting. We actually just had a hands-on laboratory at the largest veterinary conference, the North American Veterinary Conference in Orlando back in January, where we did a laboratory on forensic veterinary medicine, and actually quite a few of the animals that had been received from the local animal shelter there, we had at least half a dozen animals with very characteristic dogfight wounds, so we were able to point those out to the veterinarians to show them what to look for, and we've covered that in our textbooks, also dealing with the signs of dogfighting and better preparing veterinarians for testifying in court that, yes, these are all signs that are consistent with involvement in dogfighting and not just dogs that happen to get into a fight.
Yeah. Well, this gives us an opportunity here, and we have about maybe 5-6 minutes left, an opportunity to at least talk a little bit about this area that I know you're interested in, and an area that is a growing field, and that is animal forensics, in the sense that now investigators who would be looking into potential cases of abuse and neglect of animals are using some of the same techniques, some of the same forensic techniques that are applied by investigators who are looking at human crimes, that is, crimes committed against humans. They're taking some of those same things and applying them to potential crimes against animals and providing a lot more information about what may or may not have happened. And I understand this is something that a field that is growing more and more, and particularly in recent years.
Yeah, unfortunately, the ASPCA has been, I think, in a leadership position on this, with our staff publishing the first two textbooks on the topic, and also we just last December put on the road the world's first mobile animal crime scene investigation vehicle, which is equipped with not only materials for the treatment of animals that have been subjected to cruelty, but also the proper collection and documentation of evidence. And just 2 weeks ago, we had the first international conference on veterinary forensics in Orlando. We had representatives from 9 countries, about 175 people. Most of the speakers were human forensic experts, but who are applying their talents. And why this has become both necessary and productive is, again, as our laws become tougher and as the penalties for animal cruelty become more serious, facing sometimes 5 or 10 years in prison, the quality of the evidence that has to be presented in court has to be much better than what it was in the past when you might spend 30 days in the county jail for brutally abusing an animal. And now if you're facing 10 years in prison, you're going to have a good defense attorney, and the jury is going to expect high-quality evidence. And we do have what people sometimes refer to as the CSI effect of jurors expecting to see the blood stain analysis and the DNA proof and things like that. So what we've tried to do is work very closely with medical examiners and human forensics experts to see how much of the existing science can be applied to veterinary medicine and how much do we have to start gathering some new evidence, because animals are very similar in some ways but different in others. One way, they don't bruise the way people do. So documenting that kind of blunt force trauma and so on is more challenging.
Mm. Well, I wonder if you could give a particular example or two about ways that these kinds of techniques, the kinds of, that are drawn from investigating crimes involving humans, have been applied to this investigation of crimes against animals?
Well, getting to the issue of dogfighting again, very often if there is a dog pit involved and there will be blood stains there, and now it's become necessary to actually provide proof that this is in fact canine blood. And we had one case where the guy said, well, he just happened to be butchering a deer that he had hunted over this pit, and that's what the blood. Well, that was relatively easy to dispute that. Fairly recently we had a case where, again, the alleged dog fighter was saying this pit that had blood stains on the walls, this wasn't for fighting, this was a whelping box where his female had puppies, and that's where some of the blood had come from. And again, we had to do DNA and hormone analysis to show that, in fact, this was blood from adult male dogs, which pretty much blew that defense. So it does become that kind of cat-and-mouse game where they come up with explanations, and we have to do the science that refutes it. Another area where we're doing some new work and new research is in the area of forensic entomology, using bugs and maggots and so on that are found on or around animals that have been victimized, to demonstrate, in fact, to document time of death or how long. I had a case just a few weeks ago of an animal control officer called me from a scene in South Carolina where there had been many horses that had were dead or dying, and some had in fact been buried, and she called me from the scene saying, would it be possible to tell how long these animals have been buried here and whether or not they died of starvation? And we said, yes, we can. And I'll have someone there first thing in the morning. And we had our team out there helping excavate and taking samples, and we're able to answer both those questions.
Yeah. There was another case that I came across in some of the material that I looked at, and somehow I want to say that this was in the Northwest, where there were, a couple of places that happened in Salt Lake and in Denver, I guess those
right.
are the ones, and where there were a particular, several years ago, where there was an investigation of the deaths of a number of cats,
right.
and apparently somebody thought maybe that these cats were being deliberately killed by some person, and that you figured out that in fact, no, probably they weren't being killed by a person, they were probably being killed by another animal.
Yeah, we did have a case a few years ago in Salt Lake and Denver where actually even local veterinarians had looked at the animals, and a lot of animals were found kind of cut into, had hypothesized someone was running all around Denver, then maybe going up to Salt Lake and hacking animals in two. We assembled a team, met with the crime scene people, and I called for the first time. I called in some local wildlife people and said, tell me where you've got foxes, tell me where you've got coyotes. And when we sort of superimposed that map over where animals found, there was a pretty good match. And when we did a much closer examination under the microscope of the actual wounds, it was quite obvious that these had been gnawed or bitten. And we were basically able to confirm that virtually all the animals had been killed either by coyotes, foxes, or in some cases, birds of prey. And each leaves fairly distinct stuff. And again, veterinarians received no training in doing that kind of analysis, and we had to bring in some wildlife experts and veterinarians trained in looking at that. And that actually helped calm the community down because they were afraid there was some raving psychopath running around. And one cat owner even said, well, it kind of makes me feel a little better knowing that the cat was taken by a coyote rather than some lunatic hiding in my bushes. And we had a similar case in Spokane. We've had cases in Tustin, California, a couple of cases in Texas. As we encroach more and more into wildlife habitat and as coyotes get bolder and bolder, I live about 9 miles from the White House here in D.C., and we've seen coyotes in our neighborhood, that increasingly we are seeing those kinds of interactions, and most people aren't prepared to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point we're going to have to finish up. For people who are interested in more reading about various kinds of animal welfare issues, I suggest you go to the ASPCA website, which is www.aspca.org, and you can read more. And I'll say thanks to our guest, Dr. Randall Lockwood. He's the Senior Vice President for Anti-Cruelty Initiatives and Training at the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And Dr. Lockwood, thank you very much.
Thank you.